Good morning. What I want to do over the next few moments is to begin to bring us into a space where we can begin to see how we can take back control of our attention. Because you may not know it, but we basically had it hijacked over the last decade or so. So let me just briefly review what Annette has been saying, is that we are essentially evolved to be a threat assessment instrument. That's what our brains do, and that's what they prefer to do. That's what it prefers to do. Now, to some extent, that's been mitigated, it's been moderated, by the sense that we've also had the opportunity and spent a lot of our time connecting with the real world in a way that let us see that ultimately it's not always threatening. So we have for the last, I have to remember my daughter's age to tell you how long, but I won't tell you how long because I don't want to tell you my daughter's age. Anyway, for the last 30 years or so, we've lived on a farm. And despite ourselves, bad internet connection, no TV channels, we have been gracefully spared much of the things that have been spread across society. And so we weed gardens, plant them periodically, move them around. And so we have a felt sense of what it's like to watch the seasons move, fall on the ice a few times in the winter, and then get up and walk around in the summer. But what we know is that over the last while, there's been a active attack to actually capture our attention. We know, for instance, that advertisements really feed to, it's no secret, we all know it but we can't avoid it, feed to the needs that we have that we don't belong. And that this is what is going to help us really connect to the people that we really most admire, as if that were true. We also know that social media is set up to be addictive. And that despite ourselves, once we engage in that, we're all subject to that addictive process. And it tends to do that by making us feel threatened if we don't know. Now, the process is described in a really interesting book. It's a short read called The World Beyond Our Head, and where the author actually details the actual processes that create that addiction. Experimental psychologists have known that since the 50s, which is that it's called random intermittent reinforcement. And so they want to actually periodically have something pop up that grabs their attention, and then it disappears. I scan to see when it's going to come up again. And we also know that's an extremely hard addiction to break. It takes a long time to extinguish that need. And that's all based upon the way the brain works. It's not really based upon what we essentially would will ourselves to do. So we have to understand that mindfulness is important because willpower is overrated. My ability to disconnect from those sorts of processes just because I want to is almost nil. Bit more bad news than good news. So the same author wrote another book called Shop Class of Soulcraft. And he's kind of an interesting fellow. I don't know him, but he gives his sort of bit of his biography. He's a philosopher from a prestigious PhD in philosophy from University of Chicago, which is very prestigious, who simply couldn't tolerate all the intellectual stuff he was doing that really seemed to him not to be connected, and so bought a motorcycle shop in Richmond, Virginia, and so writes philosophy from there in the midst of fixing motorcycles. But Shop Class's Soulcraft says that we really are trying to connect to the experienced world, because we now have developed a society where we primarily connect to the virtual world. And there's some things about connecting to the experienced world that are very, very healing. The first is, when you complete a project, if you've been working on something manual, it actually gets completed. How many of us actually complete projects at work that actually feel like they're finished? So there's always this sense in front of us that something isn't completed. And trying to finish things, because that's what we're wired to do, becomes almost impossible. And then it keeps driving us to try to finish. So his solution is to buy a motorcycle. Anyway, his solution won't work for all of us, but it does say that we have to begin to find a way to connect with the experienced world so that we can connect with a different way of being with ourselves. So when we talk about mindfulness, we also recognize that, and that's described a bit of the physiology, but there's a small part of it that's really relevant here, is that when we're not paying attention to anything, something called the default mode network, which is one of a series of networks in the brain, is actively scanning for threat. In other words, when we're doing nothing with our mind, it's doing something for us that probably is not very useful, always looking for threat. So the nice thing about mindfulness is when I bring my attention to something, I interrupt that process. And as Lynette has said over and over again, we're always attending to something. And so when I bring my active attention to something that's wholesome and regenerative, I interrupt that process. But I also begin to bring things into me that allow me to see the world in a more nuanced way. So this is not about saying that the world is great, we just have to be positive. No, not at all. It's about we are being connected to things in a way that have us continually reinforcing that threat response, which makes it much more difficult to let go of. Now, nobody's a villain here. Marketers market. Social media people want to get rich. I mean, nobody is really trying to cause harm, but the process is invasive. So think about that. We do it, we all do. I'm a devout anti-social media, and that is the only person I know who can actually use it well. But the news does the same thing. I'm a news addict. So what do? Do I read the news? Of course not. I read the headlines. Why? Because the headlines grab me. But the headlines summarize the news in a way that's meant to grab me. When I take a breath and actually read the article, it's nowhere nearly as solidly, intensely that way as the headline would make me believe. It's nuanced. There's a possibility that it isn't really true. There's a question that here that we need to look at. But when I'm reading the headline, it seems so certain. Why? Because they want to grab my attention. So part of mindfulness is learning to take back your attention and use it where you want to. That's why we practice. That's why we meditate. That's why when we walk, we pay attention to the walk. We're training our brain to come back to be where we want it to be. It's going to go 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 times, and each time it goes, our training is to bring it back to where we want it to be. Over and over and over again. Because the way we disconnect from these processes is not to say, I don't want to do that. The way we do that is we practice over and over again, bringing our attention back to the breath. So we're practicing focusing our attention as we want to focus our attention. That's why it's so difficult, and that's why it's so important. So the other thing, and this is a bunch of research, it's there, so it's not terribly important to go through the research, but the actual outcome is this, is that as we are living more virtually, what we're also doing is we're favoring the hemisphere of the brain that sees things in segments. And we're not favoring the hemisphere of the brain that sees things as a whole. Interesting conversation between Lynette and Marie-Andre about basically the iPhone, which is getting you from place A, from A to B. Okay. If you look at it, it gives you directions for getting there, but it doesn't give you the map that shows you where you are. And so what it's doing is it's saying, Google Maps is saying, here's A to B. This is how you get here, the most efficient way, and that's the path. But does it tell you what it's embedded in? It says, I might get there a more interesting way that allows me to connect to those spaces in a way that I choose, as opposed to going the most efficient way. It may not be as much fun. Rarely is it as much fun. So we move away from those highways and those back roads that allow us to actually experience the journey, and we're on a ubiquitous four-lane highway. They all look the same, going from A to B. So we begin to miss the journey. We begin to miss the connect with the actual environment we're traveling through. And so we don't really recognize we're going somewhere else. It just happens to be warmer or near a coastline, because we travel the same road with the same kinds of services that we stop at the same place to get there. So, what that means is really, I mean, it's, again, there's no particular thing that anybody's doing. There's no conspiracy. It's just what we've actually done to connect to the world in a way that appears to be more efficient. And sometimes efficient is not quite as much fun. And so what mindfulness does is it allows us to connect with the world that's often much more fun, certainly much more engaging, and allows us to step away from the rest of our life, which is still going to be associated with our attention being taken by something. And at least for the time that we're engaged differently, allows us to connect with ourselves in a different way. And that's where the regeneration begins. It's regenerative. So think of, we talked about interoception. which is essentially the body's way of telling us about our well-being. Heart rate tells us about our well-being. Heart rate variability, that is the ability for our heart rate to recover after exercise, for instance, tells us about our health. It tells us about our resilience. But we have a bunch of other ways that we can engage with the environment instead of the internal environment. We have five primary senses, and I'll suggest two more as well. We have sight. We have sound. We hear. We have touch. We have smell. And we have taste. So partly what you've already been doing is giving yourself a chance to experience that. When you've been eating your meals in silence, you're both using smell, sight, and taste, depending on what the item is, also touch, to experience something without the distraction of a conversation. You may be having one in your head, but you're not having one with someone else. And eventually, what you do is you begin to bring your attention back just to the act of eating. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to suggest that perhaps one of the ways that you can actually enhance that is to put down the fork or the spoon between bites to slow it down. And then begin to recognize that when you do that, there will be a change in the way you process it. We do something called a raisin exercise. If you've had an eight-week program, you've done it. But if you don't have an eight-week program, here's a brief synopsis. Is that what we get our participants to do is to take a raisin. We'll say that it's just an object. We won't call it a raisin, but it's a raisin. And then use each sense system independently to develop a idea of what that object is. So using only sight, what do you notice about this object? Using only touch, what do you notice? Smell, taste, and even hearing. Periodically, if you're really attuned, you could hear the raisin. At least I can. I think they may say something about me, but anyway. And in that process, what happens is it's almost impossible to just be with the raisin without telling a story. It's evocative. What comes up is memories about raisins as a kid, an idea of a sense of being able to connect with the raisin, but oh my goodness, I don't really want to do this. This is a raisin. I hate raisins. And just beginning to recognize when we begin to touch and connect with it in a particular way, a whole different world appears. Because whoever looks at one raisin and eventually eats one raisin at a time. And so a lot of things happen. People recognize for the first time how sweet a raisin is because they stop to taste it. They've always just taken mouthfuls of it while they were doing something else. People stop because they've been taking mouthfuls and doing something else and say, I hate raisins. This really isn't good at all. Whatever made me think. It brings up childhood memories of raisin pie or going to school with a box of raisins. It always reminds me each time we have to buy the raisins that if I try to buy near the beginning of school, I can't find them in the store anywhere, but that's another issue. Everybody still gets their kids raisins. So it brings us to, and it's intended to do this, it brings us to a way of being in the world that we notice things in a particular way when we stop and pay attention. And it connects us to things that are part of our memory in ways that we would not have done had we not paid. paid attention and you really paid attention to what we were doing. So it connects us in many ways to who we are in that moment, but it also brings us into who we've been in our lives. And it's a simple little exercise. And what we've done is we've brought every part of the sensory system into that particular observation so that people begin to actually connect with it in a very different way. It's not automatic. We take them out of automatic. And that's really, really important. Because remember, we're in a situation right now where much of what we do is automatic. It has to be. But some things that we do don't have to be automatic, and therefore we should be able to connect with that. And discerning that is extremely difficult. That's why we practice. That's why we practice. So of course, different things happen. If I'm putting together something that I just clicked together, it's done for me already. I just am part of a system that puts it together. If I try to put something together that I am trying to figure out how to make it work, then it engages a different part of my mind. And it's problem solving. And by the time I finish it, I'm going to have a level of satisfaction or dissatisfaction depending upon how well I solve the problem. So when I'm engaged in something like that, what happens is there's a start point, an end point, and a felt sense of either satisfaction or a dissatisfaction that I can actually connect to something happening. Something real. Well, when I'm doing that as well, it draws upon experiences from my whole life. I can't just look at this because I've had experience putting things together before. My father was an auto mechanic. I worked in his garage. And so some of the things that I learned to do to make it work, dredge up all that information from then, that's, my God, how many years ago? I'm 76. I was 16 or 17. Okay? 60 years ago. But it's still there for me to access. Doing something like that reminds me to be mindful. When my mind wanders, the pipe comes together on my finger and pinches it, and I say, ouch, and put a Band-Aid on it. Because if I'm not paying attention, there is a real consequence. In the virtual world, the consequences are predetermined. It's a closed system. In the real world, they're not. And there is a consequence for not paying attention. So all of these things come together as we think about mindfulness because it's, as we pointed out yesterday, it's mindfulness about something. Can it be mindfulness about how you eat your meal? Mindfulness about how you brush your teeth? Mindfulness about how you do a project? Mindfulness about how you knit a sweater? Mindfulness about how you construct something? So when we take ourselves into the real world and using mindfulness as our engagement and our lens, then what happens is what emerges is a whole way of being with ourselves that's very different than what we typically do during the day. And constructing something, even as simple as what I did, which took me less time than I thought it was going to, and had me have to find ways to jury-rig things so it would work. When I finished it, I just looked at it and said, I did that. How many times in our lives when we're doing something, at the end of it, do you say, I did that? And it felt good. it's not quite as pretty as I'd like it, yada, 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 but it felt good. Okay? Because mostly what we're doing is we're doing things that seem interminable. We have limited control over what's going to happen next. Our minds are always into the future thinking about what if. And so a project like that has a time limit. It got fixed. It's the way it is. A couple of things I got to play with. And then we're going to see if it's going to work. And it will or it won't. And if it doesn't work, I'll figure something else out. And then it will or it won't. So that ability to see a whole come together, that I can help create, that I'm paying attention to, is inherently satisfying, no matter how it turns out. Because at the end of it, there's something I'm looking at that I can have a felt sense of having something to do with. And that's what mindfulness is. Being present, noticing, connecting. And then taking in the sensations and engaging with those sensations in a way that allows me to be appreciative of how I feel, of my felt sense of having finished it, to savor that. And so now we're getting to, in many ways, remember, we've been talking about how mindfulness shows us what's happening. It connects us to how our mind works. Reminds us that it's not always in our best interest the way our mind works. And lets us stop, take a breath, connect, and begin to make a decision about the next thing as opposed to automatically flowing into. Tasks like putting the scaffolding together, knitting a sweater, making a meal, doing anything that requires us to bring our attention on what we're actually doing, that has a very prominent outcome to show us how our what we've been doing actually unfolds. Being engaged in a moment by moment flow of a process. Gives us a sense of being within ourselves that very little else will give us. And then we use our senses, our eyes, vision, our ears, hearing, our nose, smell. I'm not going to taste my project, but my taste. Okay. All of that coming together allows us to be part of what's happening and allows us to savor it. And then we're beginning to be self-compassionate. We're giving ourselves something that's energizing and regenerative. So, in the program Mindful Self-Compassion, there's something called a sense and savor walk. And thank you very much for walking mindfully. Now you get to do something different. So sense and savor is just that. It's beginning to. And we're in a beautiful environment, inside or out. The inside interior here is pretty beautiful. The outside is absolutely a wonderful fall day. Thank you for picking this weekend, this week to come here, because it really is a nice time for us to come here. Okay. And what you do is you find some object of attention, okay, that you begin to pick something in the environment. And you take the time to bring it into your senses. You savor it. You allow it to actually enter you through the senses. And when you do that, you record it into your mental hard drive. It stays there. Remember, the bad stuff stays there automatically. We're wired for that. What we don't realize is that you have to actively practice to get the good stuff in. And so in the sense and savor walk, what you're doing is you're beginning to acquire that habit of paying attention to what's around you and bringing it in a way that's regenerative. And of course your mind will wander and you bring it back. Because the intention is to actually connect with something in a way that allows it to fill you, to sort of deal with the fact that many of us get depleted easily, allows you to fill you. And it may, as you're doing it, bring you back, because this is what things happen. What we have is our brain is wired. So an experience will lead us back to an experience. So if I've had something difficult happen, boy, what piles on it is every other difficulty I've had that's related to it. And I wonder to myself, why was I thinking about that? You weren't thinking about it, the brain was. You didn't want to think about it, but the brain said, hey, these are connected. The same thing applies is when I'm beginning to do sense and savor. So if I'm standing in front of a very, very tall tree and looking at it, automatically I go back to being a 16-year-old kid in the forest behind my house, seated in front of a huge, huge pine, and waiting quietly. Not in meditation, I wouldn't have known that, but waiting quietly. Because I knew if I was quiet enough, the forest would come alive. And after about 30 minutes, and that's about the time we meditate, isn't it? All of a sudden, all that silent forest began to rustle. And the squirrels began playing in the tree. And every time I go back to that, every time I connect with the tree here, my brain takes me there and connects me. It allows me to have all of that just in that one tree here. Looking at the water and just noticing ripple reminds me of times canoeing in lakes when I was learning to canoe. In the quiet. So it allows us to really connect in a holistic way with our life, as opposed to seeing it as fragments. So mindfulness is not about fragmenting. Mindfulness is bringing our awareness so the connections that are beneficial and wholesome for us can be made. And that's the intent. That's the intent of our program here, is to show you why it's so hard to do it, and then begin to provide you with ways that you can fold it in a beautiful way in the way you live. Because life's too short. And increasingly know that. To waste wondering what I can do to be happy when there's momentary happiness almost everywhere. We all want to be happy, but the issue is that we can't always be happy. And so what we want to do is to make sure that we have what we need to know how to connect with happiness, with joy, which is being present for something beautiful that's beyond us. that reminds us, remembers us, if you will, to times when we've experienced this before. Not that it's lost, but it's still here. Not that it was then, but it can be recovered. And as we bring our attention to that, what we're doing is we're really beginning to connect to the possibility of seeing beauty as well as a feeling, a sense of well-being as well as of knowing there's a different way of connecting with things as well as the other. So it's not that we're going to create something that's always great, it's that we're going to begin to develop the balance. So mindfulness is not about bliss. Mindfulness is about knowing how to connect with things that allow us to feel something that's really important to us. That when we stop and we sense and we savor, what we're doing is we're connecting to things that we, humanity's always needed to be able to feel human, totally human. So we're going to start the sense and savor walk in a few moments with a few instructions. One, don't rush past things. Stop it. Connect. See whether or not it's something that you would connect to. For me, sometimes it's been watching, looking down and just seeing a leaf. And just watching it as I was looking at it, just seeing it where it was, where it had fallen from, just connecting to it. And just seeing the pattern and even the beauty of the contrast between where it was. Or it might have been just looking at the water and just remembering and just noticing and just connecting. It can be moving through the building here and just taking the time to see how people have arranged things, or one of the prints that may be here that's kind of interesting. It connects you to something. So it's your own experience and your own exploration. But you have a while. It's not as if you've got to rush. There's no particular instructions other stop, notice, and if drawn to it, savor what's in front of you. Recognizing we are privileged today and at this whole period to be in the presence of immense beauty. And just allowing ourselves to connect with that in a way that in many ways nourishes.